Thank you very much indeed, Pam, and thanks to Pam and all the Wild Ones for inviting me here. It's always a pleasure, and it's always slightly intimidating, for me anyway, to talk about restoration in the Midwest, because I tend to feel that many people in the audience, or should I say the congregation, probably know more about it than I do. And the Midwest is where I discovered restoration. What I propose to do tonight is to talk a little about restoration in general. And again, those of you who are very familiar with the theory and practice of restoration, forgive me, but I think it's also helpful for you to have an idea of where I'm coming from before I go into other territory. I'm going to then talk about a few of the sites I've visited around the world. My book, I think, if there is anything unique about it, is that I think it is the first or one of the first books to look at restoration in a global context, to attempt to say what happens when you try and restore ecosystems in different ecological, geographical contexts, but also, let's not forget the people, when you try and restore in different social, economic, and political contexts. So restoration, for me, was a word until I was in my early 50s and came to the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. Restoration to me was something that you did to a car, or to a painting, or to a house. And I think I had grown up with a concept of nature and humanity which was very separated. So what do we do with nature? I thought we really only had two options. One was that we develop for our own use, and in that development we tend to degrade and we tend to destroy. So our relationship with the environment is somehow inherently a negative one. But there is something we can do, and that is the opposite of develop, which is apparently to preserve. I always think, actually, on reflection, that preserve is a very odd word to use. And in a sense, the idea of preservation, I associate it closely with the American National Parks model, Yosemite in particular, perhaps. And this is a model that got picked up and taken around the world, particularly to East and South Africa. And essentially the idea is, to make a national park, you throw out the people who may have lived there for centuries, you build a fence around it, and you say the only role for people in this park is either as tourists, visitors, for educational purposes, recreation, whatever, and scientists. But there's no other real human relationship with nature in the park. So nature's out there preserved behind a fence, and we're on this side of it living in an unpreserved world. As if this church, as if each of our bodies wasn't an ecosystem in itself, in constant communication and connection with everything else. I mean, the very word preserve, I think if you think about it for a moment, it suggests, you know, what you did in a Victorian pantry with fruit. You seal it in a glass jar and it's cut off from everything else. Well, ecologically, this is nonsense. The national park, you may think you've cut it off from everything else, and you think you've kind of taken the dirty hand of humanity off it. But in fact, the national park is still connected with everything else to a greater or lesser extent. And you see this very clearly in your forest preserves in Chicago, that wonderful institution. But for the first 40, 50 years, nobody thought very much about the ecological management of the forest preserves. So they're preserved in the sense that there isn't much human management, but they rapidly fill up with something that human beings brought here, which is European buckthorn. And so they change, and they don't necessarily change for the better for our lack of management. So perhaps taking the indigenous people out of places to make national parks, apart from being ethically at the very least questionable, is not very good ecologically either. So But one weekend in the autumn of 2003, your great natural history writer and novelist, Peter Matheson, came to visit us on the writer's program at the University of Iowa and brought us out on a weekend of prairie restoration. Myself and a young English novelist, Gregory Normanton, who knew a lot more about the environment than I did, we were both kind of staggered. The very idea that you could restore an ecosystem seemed fantastical to us. It seemed impossible. And it's certainly very challenging, but we began to learn quite quickly that people were having some success in this enterprise in the Midwest. What neither of us knew when we discussed it a lot was whether this was just a particularly Midwestern exercise, perhaps a rather romantic or nostalgic exercise in kind of trying to bring back the past. And Gregory actually suggested to me one day, wouldn't this make a great subject for a book if it does exist in other parts of the world? And I had this awful moment where kind of my heart leapt and sank at the same time, because I suddenly realized that this was the book. I had been looking for a subject in natural history, and I suddenly realized that this was the book I wanted to write, but it was Gregory's idea. So I kind of went into a quiet panic for a couple of weeks, and then I took Gregory out for a drink, and then another drink, and then another drink, and I finally said to him, Gregory, are you going to write this book on ecological restoration? And he kind of looked down his nose at me in a very kind of Cambridge English way and said, my dear Paddy, he said, that's non-fiction. I don't do non-fiction. So I said, well, I do non-fiction, so is it all right if I write it? And he said, it's all right as long as you mention me every time you talk about the book. So 12 years later, I'm trying to keep that promise. So ecological restoration, what is it? You're probably, many of you, familiar with the Society for Ecological Restoration, which groups together, it's kind of a slightly unusual organization to the extent that it brings together, most of the time, because its membership is quite fractious as well, and there are many very robust and sometimes angry debates within it, but it brings together scientists and practitioners of restoration from all around the world, though there is, I think America is still by far the largest contingent within it. And the society came up with this definition of restoration. And it's problematic. It took them 5 or 6 years to agree this definition, and no sooner was it agreed than people have begun to unpick it. And I think with some justice, but I do think this central idea that it initiates or accelerates the recovery of an ecosystem, that tells us something important, that restoration is a human intervention, but it relies to a very considerable effect on the resilience, on the recuperative powers of the system itself. So it's a kind of, you enter into a kind of a dance, you could say, with the system. Restoration means all sorts of different things and maybe a lot of things at once. It means, I think for many of us, restoring the plants and animals that used to be associated with a particular site. But it can also mean restoring ecosystem goods and services, restoring natural capital. And it's also restoring, I think this is important, it's restoring our relationship, our positive engagement with nature. I think there are many sides to restoration, but I think the one that I would give most emphasis to as a kind of guiding principle is that we are not restoring to the past. We can't restore to the past. By definition, the past is over and done with. And in fact, my original title for this book was Restoring the Future, because I wanted to get away from the idea of some kind of nostalgia for the past and emphasize that we're working in the present towards the future. But does that mean the past has no relevance? No, the past has a great deal of relevance to restoration because it provides us with a template, a guide to what the system was in the past. And I see restoration essentially as an exercise in, if you think of it as a train that has been, it's a very crude analogy, but a train that has been derailed by the damage we've done to the system. You've got to try and imagine where the train would be at this point and into the future and put it back on that track. It's not trying to create a carbon copy of the past, but it is saying if these species existed here in the past, at least most of them are probably appropriate into the future, though the system being dynamic will change. I think one of the problems with restoration is that in the period it was developing, particularly, say, around Aldo Leopold and or just post-Aldo Leopold at the Madison Arboretum. I'm sorry, I've been talking a lot and my voice is running out. That there was a kind of, there were two guiding ideas. And one of them was the idea of a pristine landscape to which we should be returning. And this pristine landscape, and you still get restorationists talking in this language. Bill Jordan, who's a very great restoration writer and thinker who I argue with in my head almost every day of my life, and I argue with him by email once a week or once a month, and I have enormous respect for his work, but he talks about removing the mark of the human from the landscape in some contexts. And I do fear that this is based on a particularly colonial fallacy. It's based on, it's common in Australia, it's common enough in South Africa, and I think it's particularly common in America. And it's the idea that the ideal target for restoration is pre-white settlement. Well, why? Why that target? Why not a target 300 years earlier? Because the system has been changed and managed by human beings in many different ways. Native Americans did not always do one thing with the landscape. They did many different things. And there are many options there, if you like, for us. But one way or another, people did manipulate the landscape prior to white European settlement, prior to industrialization. There are many changes in the land that we need to, they're not obvious to us, but we need to look at them closely. The other concept that tended to guide restoration in the early years was the idea of the balance of nature, a sort of Clemencian succession, natural succession, that would always reach a climax ecosystem, and this was kind of the ideal ecosystem that would persist in equilibrium forever. Now again, you know, it's natural enough that humans should think this on a human time scale. If you live in the Northern Hemisphere, and particular parts of the Northern Hemisphere, where if you abandon an agricultural field in Ireland, for example, it will probably return to oak forest more or less of its own accord over the next 50 years. But that kind of natural succession doesn't happen in Southwest Australia, for example. And furthermore, the closed canopy oak forest in Ireland won't last forever. Glaciation or something else will change it in the future. So ecosystems are dynamic. So this restoration enterprise looks more difficult all the time because we're actually trying to restore something based on the past towards the future, and that target is moving all the time because the system itself is dynamic. I mean, there are going to be extinctions in the future with or without human mismanagement. And extinction, historically speaking, has been an essential part of the process of evolution. It's a painful thought, but it's true. So should we be, as Bill Jordan argues, should we be restoring in some way for the sake of the system itself and then leaving it alone unmanaged? I'm just not sure either that's necessarily the best goal or that it's a practical goal. And why not? Because we restore in a world that is human-shaped. And here you see the Cinque Terre in Liguria in Italy. What you're seeing there, those wavy gray lines, are dry stone wall terraces. And over at least 1,000 years, possibly 2,000 years, human beings have been literally building this landscape. Because between the terraces is very fertile soil that was created by human beings. This is a geologically very unstable slope, very subject to landslips, and they stabilized it with the stone wall terraces, and they brought seaweed up from the sea, they brought soil from beyond the ridge, and they formed their own new soil, very, very fertile, productive industrial, productive agricultural system. And this actually presents us with a really difficult restoration conundrum today. Because there you see the terraces, the lighter green is where they're still productive, where they're still being farmed. The darker green is not alien invasive plants, but native Mediterranean vegetation coming back in there. So your first response to that photograph would probably be, well, isn't this wonderful? It's spontaneous ecological restoration, the system restoring itself. Well, yes, but. And the but is a very big one, because as these shrubs and then trees come in, accompanied by wild boars, they begin to tear apart the dry stone wall system. The stone walls begin to roll down the hill. They develop huge momentum. Some of you may remember on the news 3 or 4 years ago, the village of Vernazza, the main street, within half an hour, filled up with 4 meters deep of mud, stone, cars and buses, everything got driven down there by the force of the collapse of this system. So, obviously there's a human security reason to restore these terraces, but there's also a biological reason to do it. Because, first of all, Mediterranean vegetation on this coast, the natural vegetation, is pretty common. There's no particular need to restore it on this 20 kilometers of coastline. But these terraces offer particular spaces to some very rare, even endemic species, particularly insects and amphibians. So there's a good reason for keeping these terraces there. And if you allow the native vegetation to come back, the next step is that you get these collapses, and on the collapsed slopes, they keep moving, so that even pioneer plants get very little purchase on them. And so what you think is spontaneous ecological restoration, and indeed it is, but it actually leads, unless we manage it, to less biodiversity, not more. So what we're doing here is we're restoring a cultural landscape. And that is the aim of the Cinque Terre National Park. It's a difficult endeavor because to restore these terraces requires a lot of people doing a lot of hard labor. That's not easy to achieve. But that's kind of an obvious instance of a cultural landscape. Where it's far less obvious is in the Midwest, where you've prairie savanna. And that is why, for so long, white settlers did not understand the degree to which Native Americans had been managing the landscape. But the more, and particularly in research of the last 30 years, the more we look at any system, the Amazonian rainforest, the Lacandone forest in Mexico, we realize that these rainforests have been farmed for centuries, sometimes for millennia, and that some people today are saying there may not be a square kilometer in the Yucatan in Mexico that wasn't farmed at some stage. So that what we see as pristine landscapes are actually something different. And if you want to restore a landscape, you've got to understand its deep history, its ecological history and its cultural history. And that's certainly not easy. I'd also just like to say in passing that if we're restoring ecosystems, we are always restoring ecosystems in a social context. There are always people in the picture to some degree. And I don't want to dwell on this point tonight, but I think it's vital to understand that you cannot do restoration successfully, no matter how good you are technically. You cannot do it successfully in the long term, particularly on public land, unless you have the permission of the public. So there's an exercise of engagement there, which is not the same as telling people what is best for the, what you believe is best for the environment, but you've got to engage with people, find out what they value in their landscape, and work with that in a democratic consensus. Now, I think restoration offers us a great deal of hope. As I say, for me, it was this kind of light bulb moment when I realized that it might be possible to roll back some of the damage we'd caused to the landscape. That does give us a great deal of hope. But I don't want to be, or appear to be, starry-eyed about restoration, because restoration is occurring in this social context, a social context where population worldwide is going to rise by at least another 2 billion by 2050. We are putting staggering pressure on the Earth's resources. We are putting staggering pressure on the Earth's atmosphere and the whole global ecosystem through human accelerated climate change. And perhaps above all, and all these things again are connected, perhaps above all, we are putting inexcusable pressure, because I think the pressure, you know, we're very judgmental sometimes if we see people in Brazil chopping down rainforest, forgetting that we've chopped down most of our own forests in the Northern Hemisphere at some stage. But people, you know, have a choice between starvation and destroying or damaging their immediate ecosystem. We'll choose to do that damage. What's much more disturbing is that our whole social model at the moment, it seems to me, the model of consumer capitalism, is based on the idea that we are only happy when we have more this year than we had last year. It's not based on what we need. It's based on, I would argue, and I've believed since the 60s, that there are advertising and the corporate machine is almost injecting desire, or, I don't want to say unnatural desires, but desires in us that are very damaging for ourselves and for the environment. And if we are all going to think that, you know, we need more shoes, more cars, more swimming pools, well, the people in Rwanda and the people in Korea and the people in Ecuador are going to look at us as they are. And they're saying, well, we want that too. And this seems to be the only game in town at the moment. And I have no idea what the solution is. Clearly, in the 20th century, socialism, as it was in the Soviet bloc at least, has failed, which seemed to be the only alternative to capitalism. Can we, and since 2008, since the financial crisis, it seems to me that capitalism is running rampant, that there is no regulation to control what I see as a beast. But I don't know what the answer is. And I don't know where the political force is that's going to change that. But I just do want to raise that flag and say, with the existing social model, it's unlikely that restoration will be more than rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, because we are facing extraordinary challenges in this century. But they're challenges that I think, from a technical, scientific point of view, can be overcome, as I hope to show you. There are lots of benefits from restoration. I've mentioned them earlier, I'm just going to move on. And I want to tell you a couple of stories from around the world about restoration projects that you may not be familiar with. This one, Working for Water, is a really extraordinary program. It began in the 1980s with a group of South African botanists who were concerned, very much in the way that the early volunteers were on the forest preserves here. They were concerned about invasive alien plants destroying native biodiversity in South Africa. South Africa has practically no natural forests. So white settlers brought in particularly Australian trees, eucalypts and Australian acacias. And these trees escape from the plantations and they infest the watersheds. And the South African leading botanists said in the 1980s, we are going to lose one of the richest botanical systems in the world if we don't do something to get rid of the trees. But they were living, and again, remember the social context, they were living in apartheid South Africa, a non-democratic society with white minority rule. And they realized that as black people and white people who opposed apartheid struggled against that system, that it was unlikely that biodiversity was going to be a priority of whatever democratic government emerged in South Africa. So they thought, we need an economic argument. So they went to hydrologists, and they said to the hydrologists, is what we think intuitively scientifically accurate? Surely all these big trees must drink a lot more water than our native small plants. And the hydrologists, without actually doing any experiments, and you'd have to do long-term experiments to prove this, said, well, yes, it's probably true. And they gave them their backing, politically anyway. And so when Nelson Mandela established South Africa's first democratic government, and his minister for water and foreign, water and forestry, Kadar Asmal, was approached by these botanists and hydrologists, he said, this is a great idea. Of course, we think South African biodiversity should be preserved, but it's great that you've given me the economic argument that you're going to augment the South African water table. That gives me great strength going to cabinet. But he said, it's not enough. He said, we've got to have a third leg to this argument. And he said, the third leg will have to be poverty relief. Nothing gets through this cabinet that is not going to contribute to relieving the acute poverty of the majority of the population. So he said, why don't we do this big? Why don't we do it as a big public works program, a bit like your Civilian Conservation Corps from Roosevelt during the Depression in the 1930s. So working for water, you see there a team, it's actually an exclusively women team working on Table Mountain near Cape Town. It's tough work, as you can see. This is a very different area of South Africa, Bavianskloof. It's spread right across the country, employs anything between 60 and 80,000 people a year, multi-million dollar budget, and it's portrayed generally in the media as the kind of flagship project of Mandela's Rainbow Nation. It's, I think, seen with two starry eyes some of the time as a win-win-win project. It restores biodiversity, it restores natural capital in the form of water, and it restores poor human communities. The difficulty with this program, and this is not to say that the program shouldn't exist, on the contrary, I think it's a model program, but the difficulty with it is that if you try and do three good things at once, it is at least possible, and I think in the case of working for water, it's proved to be the case, that they don't always work in synergy. They will pull against each other and they may damage each other. And the most obvious example is that if you were to try and get rid of invasive alien plants in South Africa on a purely ecological basis, well, you would do a plan that targets the most affected areas. Or you might do a plan, there are two ways of looking at it ecologically, you might do a plan that targets the least affected areas and works out from them. Either way, it would be based on where the invasive alien plants actually are. But if you do a public works program to relieve poverty, well, then what happens? Every city, every rural township, every village wants a slice of that program, and they've a right to it. So the program gets spread thinly over the country, and the worst affected areas aren't targeted properly. Lots of problems like that in the program, but the really wonderful thing about the program is the attitude of its leaders and senior management, which is, and I have never encountered this kind of openness in any other organization I've come across, of genuine openness to criticism. They have twice invited major exterior reviews of every aspect of their program. And these reviews have come up and found some pretty serious holes in the program. They've published these reviews and they've adapted their management to deal with the problems that have been identified. So I think it's a really, really interesting large-scale restoration program. Some people question the quality, the ecological quality of it to this day. I think it's getting better all the time. But it is a wonderful example of a phrase you probably hear a lot, but very rarely see practiced, which is genuinely adaptive management. I think one of our great problems as a species is most of us are only capable of changing once or twice in our lifetimes. And so if you're part of an organization and you think you've got a solution to something, you tend to kind of rigidify that and cling to it. Whereas actually, in a fast-moving world, we need to be flexible and adapt all the time. And I think working for water is showing ways of doing this. One more example, This is Guy Preston, the chief executive, and Buluwayo Dikana, one of his employees. And they're playing chess, no big deal, you might think. But one of the problems that Working for Water faces is, what do you do when you take out these hundreds of thousands and millions of big trees? What do you do with the biomass? What do you do with the wood? Because if you just leave it stacked up and it burns, well, then it will burn with a ferocity that may sterilize the soil. You've got to do something with it. You've got to find some way of moving it around and using it. So these are school desks for schools in very poor areas, and they got the idea that on every school desk they would build in chessboards so the kids would learn chess almost while they were at school. And they have, there are many, many, another program they had was economic coffins. South Africa, unfortunately, with the AIDS epidemic, the cost of funerals was crippling many poor families. And this was a way of relieving that particular aspect, only one small aspect, but that aspect of their stress. Moving around the world a little to Chiapas in Mexico, I'd like to talk for a minute about traditional ecological knowledge. I risk offending people here by what I'm about to say, perhaps, I don't know. But I grew up with films like Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, or books like Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and books like Touch the Earth. And a kind of the early environmental movement, to my mind, tended to idealize the relationship of indigenous people with the environment. And I think we need to be very, very careful about this. I think we need to treat indigenous knowledge exactly the same way as we treat any other knowledge. I think that's the only respectful way of doing it. Otherwise, there's a kind of romantic patronization of the kind of the, dare I say, the noble savage, which I think informs a lot of thinking about traditional ecological knowledge. And I went to a lot of sessions about traditional ecological knowledge in the Society for Ecological Restoration, and I was rarely convinced that there was truly ecological knowledge coming from marginalized indigenous communities. Now, I think it's very important to say at this point that I recognize that these communities have in many cases been victims of something approaching, or indeed something exactly like, genocide. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're the same species as we are, and that doesn't necessarily mean their ecological practices are always better. But I didn't want to seem a complete killjoy about this, and I kind of searched around for a project that really did show ecological knowledge that hadn't been available to science previously working in practice. And in Cuba in 2007, I met a Mexican ecologist who was working in the Lacandon jungle, Mexican-Guatemalan border. And he had come up with a practice which is still extraordinarily intact among the Lacandon Maya. Essentially, very few of the Lacandon Maya left, only about 800 of them in the jungle. But essentially, when you drive from San Cristobal de las Casas down past Palenque, down towards the Guatemalan border, you see the rainforest devastated for 5-10 kilometers on either side of the road all the way down, because some of the Mayan peoples were subsidized by the Mexican government from the 40s, 50s onwards to knock down the forest to build, to raise cattle. And they found very rapidly that the native grasses would not support cattle for very long, so they brought in African grasses, and this is a very common practice around the world. But even the African grasses didn't last very long. So these people are in really, really serious trouble now. They've knocked down the rainforest, and their land is very degraded, too degraded to profitably support many cattle. Then you hit the Lacandon section of the jungle, and the forest comes right down to the road. And so you might think, well, there are no people in there. This is nature on its own. But you go into the forest, and you find that the Lacandones are farming away in the forest, and they're farming, in their own way, quite intensively. But they work on a system of destroying small sections of the forest. They slash and burn, but maybe 2 hectares at a time. And then they cultivate on that site, and for the first 10, 15 years, they have the most productive, they call them milpas, cornfields, but they produce maybe 50 crops in this 2 hectares. But then the land begins to get tired. So they begin a process, and it's a 5-stage fallowing process, where they are effectively restoring in a kind of controlled, slow-motion way the rainforest, right back to something approaching its original state. And what fascinated this Mexican ecologist looking at their work was that they understood which plants to use in which sequence to accelerate or slow down this process. And he thought, well, if we began to apply this knowledge to the degraded land, then we might be able to restore it much faster. And he had long discussions. You get places like this where the forest has been degraded and bracken, ferns, have jumped in. These are native cosmopolitan. But the forest can never get any kind of a purchase to regenerate itself where the ferns have established themselves. Unless you know which tree will grow very fast and shade out the ferns. And this tree is actually the tree that makes balsa wood. They call it chuchum in the Lacandon language. And so he has borrowed all these technologies with their permission from the Lacandon people, and he is now restoring, with their help, other Mayan territories in the area. So I found that an extraordinary example of genuine traditional ecological knowledge being tested scientifically and used in other contexts. So this is Samuel Levi Thatcher on the left of the slide, or on the right as you're facing it, sorry. And he is the Mexican ecologist. And Don Manuel Castellanos, who is called Hachuinique. Hachuinique is kind of translated as complete man or complete person. And in the Lacandon culture, the complete person is the person who understands this process of farming within the rainforest without destroying it. Finally, in terms of a quick world tour, I want to talk to you about what, to my mind, is probably the most impressive restoration project in the world today. Impressive in the sense of its measurable success, and especially given where it starts from. What you're looking at there is the Jarrah eucalyptus forest in the hills above the city of Perth in southwestern Australia. And while it looks from a distance rather monocultural, you might even think you were looking at a plantation there, this is actually one of the most diverse forests in the world. And Alcoa Aluminium are mining for bauxite in this forest. And to mine for bauxite, they cut down the forest, obviously, and then they remove the topsoil, and then they mine 4 meters down into the overburden soil beneath the topsoil. So when you stand in one of these red pits, you really are at ground zero, biologically speaking. There is very little microbial life, which is ultimately the foundation of all life, very little microbial life remaining in the ground on which you're standing. And yet, within 20 years, they are getting this forest back. And they are getting, and this has been, they have spent some money on this, and they employed leading scientists in the field to do an inventory of all of the measurable biodiversity within the forest. And 98% of the biodiversity is back in 20 years' time. Why is 2% missing? Because a lot of animals, particularly insects, reptiles, some birds, depend on dead wood for habitat, for food, whatever. There isn't much dead wood in a very young forest. So now they're bringing in dead wood to try and get that 2% back. Now, yes, there are huge questions here. I'm not suggesting we should go around the world knocking down forests and rebuilding them. But if they have a license to mine anyway, isn't it much better that they restore well rather than restoring badly? And what the big questions are, this forest is 4 meters lower than the old forest. That changes its relationship to the water table, to the minerals in the soil, to all sorts of things. So in terms of my idea of getting an ecosystem back on track, what kind of track will it be on in 50 or 100 or 200 years' time? We simply don't know. But at the same time, I think what this does show us is that, and this is absolutely critical, it's very crude, but if we put enough money into restoration, we can restore in extraordinarily difficult circumstances. Because what I want to talk to you about now is a movement within restoration and within conservation generally, which is kind of beginning to say, let's give up the struggle. It's too difficult. Society's not buying into it. You may have come across books like Ragamuffin Earth by Emma Maris. You may have come across the concept of novel ecosystems. And I think this is one of the biggest challenges facing restoration and conservation today. And some of it is coming in good faith from leading figures within the movement. The tiny human figure there is Richard Hobbs, who's a really fine restoration scientist. He edited the only major academic journal in the field, Restoration Ecology, for its first 10 years. And from 2006 onwards or so, he began to question whether restoration was actually possible given the pressures we are under from climate change, invasive alien plants, increasing population pressure, land degradation, all the factors I mentioned a little earlier. And so he came up with this idea of novel ecosystems. He said that, you know, maybe your buckthorn, the rich growth of buckthorn in your forest preserve, maybe we should just celebrate that and learn to love it. And I think he touched on a number of interesting things. And one of the things it's really important to say is that he is recognizing how serious the challenges to restoration are. And we've got to take them that seriously. And perhaps he also touched on a kind of a weak point, that there is nothing wrong with buckthorn. I'm delighted when I see buckthorn in Ireland. It's a very rare tree, doesn't behave invasively. And it has its attractions, clearly, for many species. Birds love it. So there's nothing wrong with buckthorn, except that we have put it in a place where it does damage to the native ecosystem. So I think maybe in that sense he was making a useful point. He argued in the early articles that climate change changes everything, and that things are moving so fast with climate change that the idea of using the past as a guide to the future is now obsolete. And to give you an example of what he means, there's an American ecologist working in Costa Rica, Patricia Townsend. And I've heard her describe very dramatically how she's working on a particular mountain. And if you roughly divide the mountain into zone C towards the bottom, zone B in the middle, and zone A at the top, she is seeing over a 10-year period vegetation from zone C move up into zone B. And zone B vegetation, where it can find niches, is moving up into zone A. And zone A is nowhere to go, it's disappearing. So she asks the question, and this is one of the questions Richard Hobbs would ask us. She's asking the question, should I be restoring zone C today? Should I be starting to restore it in zone B, and zone B in zone A, etc.? Is that the most useful thing to do? Because if I'm trying to restore zone C where it's existed historically, and it can no longer thrive there, well then maybe I'm wasting scarce conservation resources. These are big dilemmas, I believe. So Richard Hobbs and his colleagues, who are known as H-cubed because they're Richard Hobbs, restoration ecologist, Jim Harris, soil ecologist, and Eric Higgs, Canadian philosopher. So they became known as H-Cubed because they authored most of the important articles. And they ask these kind of questions. Is it appropriate to consider temperate woodland restoration in an area likely to be flooded by rising sea levels? Is it appropriate to re-establish wetland, in an area that may be semi-arid in 50 years' time? Now, I think those are questions we've got to think about. In Europe, we have special areas of conservation which are very much species-based. You know, they're there because they're not necessarily because of the whole system, but because five or six or maybe only one species of bird or plant exists there, and it's rare. But now we're beginning to find that some of these species are they don't know it's a special area of conservation. They just want to survive, and they're moving out. So what do we do? Do we try and make our conservation maps flexible? What happens if there's nowhere for them to go? These are perplexing, troubling questions. Where I get a little bit worried is a kind of switchover in the thinking of these people who see themselves as being very avant-garde in the restoration movement. They say, active ecological restoration of appropriate sites in new locations would appear to be one answer. But you have to ask yourself, what does that really mean? I mean, does it mean that you should start restoring Mediterranean landscapes close to Paris? How would you do that? Restoration of historical systems on their own sites is difficult enough. But if you start moving species, say, further uphill or further north, you're moving them to different soils. And those soils aren't going to change or adapt for a much longer period. So this is a very tricky exercise. And maybe it should be done as an experiment. But should it become the general practice, as they seem to be suggesting? Now, I want to stress, because I disagree with these people very strongly, I want to try and be as fair to them as I possibly can. They did warn in their early articles about the dangers in their approach. They talk about the danger that there could be hubris, too much pride, in presuming that we can understand and predict ecological change. I think the problem is that they then proceeded to do just that. They talk very movingly about the pain of what they're saying. They point out that most of us learned about nature in particular places and particular communities of plants and animals that we fell in love with when we were 5 or when we were 15. And those are the things that stay with you for the rest of your life, and maybe you go back to those places, at least in your imagination. And they nurture you in some way. Hopefully, you know, like Wendell Berry, you can keep going back to the same places and gain that nourishment from them. What if that is no longer possible? That's a very painful prospect. The philosopher Eric Higgs talks about how he has found it a real challenge to collaborate with Richard Hobbs and James Harris on these papers. And he says, how do we decide which species to keep only in the zoo? Which plants to keep only in the seed bank? I think it's great they're putting these questions out there. They force us to think very hard. This, I think, is the most interesting figure that they've come up with to explain what they're talking about. So if you look at the green area, I hope it's probably rather distant from some of you, but on this screen, but you can see it there, the historical ecosystem, and you can see arrows moving into what they call a hybrid ecosystem, which is what we would call a moderately changed or degraded ecosystem. And those arrows are two ways. So the hybrid system you can still restore. Beyond that is what they call the novel ecosystem. And there they say, once the system tips over to a novel state, then there are black lines and the arrows don't come back. So they say you can't restore novel ecosystems. Well, I would ask, what is more novel? And I'll talk about the problem of that word in a minute. What is more novel than what we have just seen in the Australian mining site? What possibly could be more novel than you've removed the forest, you've removed the topsoil, you've removed 4 meters of subsoil, and you're at ground zero. What could be more novel than that that we're restoring there? So why should we give up at this particular point when the science is getting good? What I really question is whether the threshold, they talk about these barriers here as being thresholds that are irreversible. Is the threshold really a scientific one? Because one of the things, you go through their papers and you're not going to find a clear scientific data-based definition of a novel ecosystem. So maybe the threshold isn't an ecological one. Maybe it's a social, political, economic one. Are we prepared to pay for restoration? Of course, restoration is more difficult the more degraded the system gets. But that does not mean that it is scientifically impossible. Now, I come from a humanities background, and I'm a writer, and I'm interested in words. And I'm very curious about why Richard Hobbes, first of all, chose the word novel to describe these systems. Because it would be much more accurate to describe them as something like chronically degraded ecosystems. And there's a reason for this that Richard Hobbes is very upfront about. The reason is that his editor of a peer-reviewed journal said to him, Richard, he was calling them initially emerging ecosystems. And the editor said, that's not exciting enough. It's not catchy enough. Why don't you call them novel ecosystems? And if you think about it, in our culture, what is novel is what is attractive. It's sexy. It's what we're taught to want. And so I think it was very dangerous for him to accept this editorial guidance for the sake of a few more citations. I think it was really, really dangerous to choose this word novel. And then I began to see a kind of a, you know, where choosing one image, one adjective, can lead you in a particular metaphorical direction that takes on its own momentum. Because the next thing they began to talk about was a new ecological world order. And you think, well, actually, it's a new ecological world disorder. So it's not novel, it's degraded. It's not an order, it's a disorder. And they were writing shortly after the first Iraq war, and the second Iraq war, and when Bush and Blair talked about a new world order. Whether you agree with them or not, you have to understand that they meant something positive. They thought they were creating a good thing. So if you start talking about new ecological world order, again, it has this positive ring. And then, given that context, the bizarre thing was that they then began to talk about intervention ecology. And for those of us who lived through the Bush and Blair period, we remember the word intervention was used again and again and again. And we create democracy and dictatorships by intervention. So you get this idea of not just the necessary management for an ecosystem, but very aggressive management. And then it turns, I think, into something else. So are these phrases describing something in a scientific sense, or are they actually rhetoric being used to force a change of policy? Or I shouldn't say force, to encourage a change of policy. Now, there's nothing wrong with writing about policy, but don't disguise it as science. Visual example here from my own country, in fact, very close to my own home, rhododendron. Rhododendron ponticum does to Irish oak forests what Irish buckthorn does to your forest preserves. So if you look at that, you could say it's pretty obvious it's a chronically degraded ecosystem. But look at that. It's the same plant. It's a few hundred yards away. It's very beautiful. So maybe it's a novel ecosystem. So, you know, it's the same thing. And as I say, it's not the rhododendron's fault, what it's doing. But I think the language we use to describe things is very important. And intervention for a new world order, I just found it so bizarre that they were using these terms in the wake of all that political rhetoric about intervention in the Middle East. God knows we're seeing the result of that today. The response from their critics has been interesting within the restoration movement. Some of their critics have, I believe, been very knee-jerk, very reactive. They've just got angry and shouted at them. They don't talk with them, they shout at them. One of the things I've tried to do during this period has been at Society of Ecological Restoration conferences to organize platforms where you get everyone on the platform and where they have to talk to each other and with each other rather than simply against each other. Because I don't really think there are any bad people in this movie. I think there are people who've moved strongly in one direction, are trying to show us some things, but perhaps also misleading us in some ways. And that's a normal process and has to be dealt with by dialogue. Some people within the movement have, I actually got a phone call once asking me if I could use my influence, and I don't have anything like this amount of influence, but could I use my influence to get a symposium on novel ecosystems dropped from an ecological conference? And I said, absolutely not. I'd much rather go to it and make the arguments. But there have been a lot more, I would say, intelligent engagements with the arguments. And the points made against it are largely these, that in scientific terms, there hasn't been enough data produced to show even that so-called novel ecosystems exist. What's really odd about their argument is that they often create straw men. I don't know if that's a familiar phrase in American English, but essentially, very oddly, for people who've worked in restoration for 10, 20 years and given a lot to it, they tend to caricature restoration. They tend to talk about restoration as this kind of romantic attempt to recreate the past. Very few restorationists. Some, yes, for sure, but the majority of restorationists are not working in that way today. And above all, I believe they are confusing a scientific threshold, a scientific barrier, with a social and economic one. And H-cubed, Richard Hobbs and his colleagues, they've also got into this kind of very negative form of arguing, where they caricature their critics as romantics, nostalgics, ostriches with their heads in the sand, etc., etc. And one of the things I found curious about watching this process is how within science and within the environmental movement, you get the same kind of polarization, the demonization of the other, that you get in armed conflicts, which is what I'd been writing about previously. That once people take opposing positions, they begin to become completely, they begin to personalize the argument, to become very negative about the other, instead of seeing this as a spectrum of opinions which we will all move up and down a little and that you engage with. I just think this is the most important thing of all, that you engage with it. You don't just shout at each other. One of the more disturbing phrases that Hobbs and company used, I thought, was this: present beliefs require significant adjustment. I thought that was an extraordinarily, almost Orwellian phrase to use. This is one critic's rather witty response, I think. If we are restoring a painting of Jesus Christ, well, there are two ways of doing it. There's the kind of traditional type of restoration, the middle one, which tries to restore the beauty, the wholeness, the integrity of the original painting. And that's what we try to do when we restore an ecosystem. Or you could do the novel ecosystem one, which is restoring ecosystem functions regardless of what it looks like. So, you know, the figure on the other side has eyes, it has a nose, but it doesn't have any of the real qualities of the original. I was very taken by one of the novel ecosystems people actually coming up to the podium with a prosthetic leg. And he said, this leg has none of the beauty, none of the warmth, none of the sensuality of a human leg. But if you've had your leg cut off, it does help you to walk. And that's the point. Maybe there are some cases, some systems, where we need to just do with the functions. But on a case-specific basis, let's not assume we have to do this everywhere. I'm running a little short of time, so I'm just going to run over some of the final arguments quickly, but there was an edition of Science magazine in 2009 which celebrated ecological restoration. And the editors of Science said that this new discipline could become the most important environmental science in the future. Remarkable tribute, and there were lots of essays in this supplement. What was really odd is that Richard Hobbs, who was still editor of Restoration Ecology at the time, made these two comments, and I think they're really, really disturbing. For many ecosystems, how many? He keeps seeming to say most or almost all. For many ecosystems, restoration to a historic standard is anachronistic. Ecological restoration finds new moorings, they don't seem to me like moorings at all, in emphasizing restoration of ecosystem function, goods, and services. As I say, without the qualities of the whole system. And then the extraordinary jump they make, developing our capacity to engineer ecosystems successfully. Well, this is what I think is the key contradiction in their position. They begin by telling us that ecological restoration is very difficult in the first place, and under conditions of climate change, land degradation, etc., it is now impossible. But then they say, we can engineer entirely new ones. Well, I think that's an extraordinary leap from humility to hubris, and a very, very dangerous one. And you know, we have engineered a lot of the world as it is, and any good scientist will tell you that within any ecosystem, if we think of an ecosystem in the abstract as an equation, we don't know most of the variables in it. So how on earth can we start engineering new ones? Now, again, maybe it's a valid experiment to do from time to time and place to place, but to say that this is restoration seems to me to be patently nonsense, quite honestly. I do think the warnings that Hobbs and his colleagues have given us are important ones, particularly, and I haven't mentioned this, the warning of moral hazard, of promising more than we can deliver. That does happen with restoration, and very often the label restoration is attached to projects that aren't really restoration at all, in terms of trying to restore as much as possible of the whole system. So I do think that's a valid warning, but as I say, I also think we need to be aware of the dangers of what Hobbs and company are proposing, and that is the engineering of entirely new ecosystems. And I think the most worrying thing about the novel ecosystems theory is its consequences for policy. I have heard a very senior person in your Bureau of Land Management say that they are now being told by their bosses, why are we putting all this emphasis and investing all this money on native plant seed? Why don't we just celebrate the novel ecosystems that are arising and changing all the time? So this is the problem. You know, you sit there with your government bureaucrat or your corporate CEO and you look out the window and you say that's a really degraded ecosystem. We've got to invest something in restoring it. And they say, no, we don't. That's not a degraded ecosystem, it's a novel ecosystem. Let's just enjoy it for what it is. That's the dilemma this shift in policy presents us with. I think, again, to pause for a second, they do make some good points, that sometimes in post-mining, in some post-mining landscapes, new communities of plants and animals do develop, and they're interesting, and they're beautiful in their own way, and people come to value them culturally, so maybe we shouldn't try and restore everything. I think that's a legitimate point. I was very happy to see that when they produced a book on novel ecosystems, for the first time after 6 years' debate, they did begin to introduce the idea of social thresholds. And that's where I want to finish for tonight, because I really think we need to think about this. Going back to the Alcoa aluminum mining restoration, the social threshold there, the economic threshold, what we need to get a corporation or a society through its taxes to pay. Maybe it's a crippling amount of money. Maybe we can't afford it. And then that would be a threshold that we cannot cross. And maybe we'd have to put up with degraded ecosystems. But this restoration, which is, as I say, state of the art, they spend many millions of dollars on it. But those many millions of dollars, which are a lot of money to you or I, they represent about 1% of Alcoa's profits from this site. So it's a very small, in this case, self-imposed environmental tax. So I think the social threshold to restoration, if we are active in our societies, in our democracies, to persuade other people that it's worth investing in natural infrastructure, the way we invest without question in built infrastructure. You know, your road starts to fall apart, your government or your county or whoever repairs your road. But again and again and again, we let ecosystems degrade because of our actions, and we don't, you know, it's like there's all these ecological unpaid bills all over our landscapes. And I really believe, despite the challenges we face, we can afford and we must commit ourselves to paying them. And it will, not only will it not cripple our society, in time, it will return benefits that are far greater than that economic investment. So, concluding, I think there's no better call to restoration, to good restoration, than this one from your great biologist, E.O. Wilson. Let us go beyond mere salvage to begin the restoration of natural environments. There is no purpose more inspiriting, very interesting word for an atheist to use, no purpose more inspiriting than to begin the age of restoration, reweaving the wondrous diversity of life that still surrounds us. And that's Wilson working on restoration in his 80s in Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique. Thank you very much indeed.